My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock. And I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, the thing is, I want to learn. And as it turns out, I work with people who know a lot about classical music. Every week on this show, one of my coworkers will give me a homework assignment, a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I am Daisha Clay, and here with me in the studio today, my instructor is Joel Lukes, who is on the editorial staff of Culture Map Houston. He's also a columnist for that website. He is a classically trained flutist who trained at the Eastman School and at the Shepherd School of Music at Rice University right here in H-Town. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thanks, instructor. Wow.
That's right.
I feel so official.
Hope you're okay with that.
I have to be now, sure.
So you have prepared a very well thought out lesson today. We're going to see the evolution of flute playing, but through a particular lens. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I think every instrument has a stereotype, you know, and every instrument player has a stereotype too. Like when we think of the harp, for example, you think angels.
Right.
It's true, right?
Yeah.
When you think of the trumpet, what do you think?
You think bombast, you think like military
exactly.
music.
Exactly, regal.
Yeah,
or
regal.
Military, yeah, exactly, that kind of thing. I love them. Regent,
yeah.
regal.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say flute, what do you think?
You think bird sounds, you think gentleness, you think that one sample from that Beastie Boys song, I can't remember which one it was.
Exactly, right?
What is that?
You know, the flute also has a reputation. There's this stereotype of just being a very gentle, very pretty instrument.
Yeah.
And that's just one of its characters. It actually has a wide range of colorful capacities.
And you're going to show us these many colorful
sure.
capacities?
Sure. Exactly. Now, it is, that reputation is deserved.
Yeah.
Because as being one of the oldest instruments, you know, if you think how flutes started, they were made out of bones. They're made out of reeds.
Really?
Yeah. Some of the instruments date back hundreds of thousands of years. And it's really, you know, a bone that's been hollowed that has, you know, little holes, and that's how you play it.
That's crazy. Like, what kind of bones did people, like animal bones?
Animal bones.
Okay, good. Not people bones.
Well, I don't know if that's part of the history, but.
Because we've had that on this show, and
oh, really?
It was creepy. Yeah.
Well, hopefully the flute has a much nicer history. Let's just say nothing cannibalistic.
All right.
But of course, you know, we also think of ethnic instruments like the Indian flute or the shakuhachi, Japanese flute, Native American flute that they're very soulful and very beautiful in how they produce their sound. When we think of the modern flute or the flute that we see in the orchestra, the one that's played sideways.
Yeah.
Really, the history of that instrument starts kind of around the Renaissance through the Baroque.
Mm-hmm.
The name that we use is traverso, which is just kind of a fancy name for saying traverse flute.
Okay.
And so that's...
Is that what you call the sideways flute, traverse flute?
Yeah, it's really sort of the name of yesteryear and how differentiated different types of flutes.
Okay.
And now we just call it a Western flute or an orchestral style flute.
Got it.
But, you know, that's where its history began. You know, it was made out of wood. It only had one key. So there wasn't a lot that you could do. And the type of wood that was used was very loud.
Yeah.
It had a lot of warmth and a lot of colorful timbres. And when I say color, musicians talk a lot about color.
Yeah, they do.
And it's something that's confusing, I think. But the way I think of color is like shades of sound.
Okay.
It's not volume. It's how the sound, maybe it's a little cottony. Maybe it's like really laser. Maybe it's a little smoky. Maybe it's a little bubbly.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. So it doesn't have anything to do with the actual volume. It has to do more with the character. It's like, you know, you have different shades of red or you have different shades of pink. It's still pink. Mm-hmm. So the history starts with this kind of pretty sound. And that's something that that changed kind of in the mid-1800s. There's this German guy, Theobald Böhm. I love saying that. Böhm. He was a silversmith, and he created this new mechanism, this new way of constructing the flute that became a viral sensation. Mm-hmm. Within a year, like, everybody needed to have this flute. This was the instrument. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, when Twitter came out, everybody was going crazy and needed to be on Twitter. Everybody needed to be
back
on this flute.
Back in the day, it was flutes.
Back in the days. This is the flute that they wanted. So 25 years later, Bizet writes Carmen. And that's when you start seeing the flute coming a little bit more out of the woodwork in terms of a solo instrument.
Yeah.
And so we're going to start by listening to that stereotype of the pretty flute.
Okay.
It's beautiful flute and harp music. You'll hear a lot of weddings. Actually, I had to play it at my sister's wedding, which I find kind of strange because if you think, do you know the story of Carmen?
No, I don't.
Well, she's kind of a temptress that ends up, she's kind of a sexy little number who plays with, you know, men's emotions. Mm-hmm. And because of that, she ends up dead.
Oh.
So it's one of those things that we play at weddings all the time, but then when I think about it, I'm thinking, is this really something that you want? You know, the history of Carmen going on where you're, you know, trying to make this union with your loved one. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I've had to do it, and I did it in my sister's wedding, and I told her the story after because I didn't want to ruin the moment.
Yeah, you just hope that you have like 100 of me in the audience not knowing what the hell you're playing.
Exactly. So, yeah. But it's sort of funny to think, oh yeah, I'm playing the music that represents a whore who is, you know, ends up dead because she, you know, didn't go through what she promised to a, you know, general who's probably a little randy. So.
Oh, love.
It's not fun. So why don't we take a listen to that?
Okay, sounds good. I can see why she would want this played at a wedding. It's really, like, lovely, melodic, sort of sweet sounding.
Lilting. Yeah, and you can walk to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it works very well for two instruments. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
That always gives me goosebumps. It's so lovely.
The swell in the music. It's nice. So this is an example of that sort of typical preconceived notion of what the flute can do. These are the limits of what the flute can do. It is a pretty instrument.
It's gorgeous.
Okay, so blow my mind and tell me that's not true.
Okay, so things start to change. What happens is the mechanism of the instrument, we get more keys.
Mm.
It responds easier to air. Yeah. So we're able to do changes, play a high note, play a low note, very, very quickly. Whereas, you know, wood doesn't necessarily respond that well. So there's a lot of, I want to say, scientific improvements to the instrument that really allows the player to be a little bit more free. So what happens is the violin, for example, is years ahead of any wind instrument. If you think of the music of Paganini or the virtuosos of the Romantic era, I mean, they were tearing stuff up on their instruments. And they were rock stars. They were rock stars of the day, you know? And flutists kind of weren't. Mm-hmm. So it kind of took a while for music, for the flute to be written in that style. So what do? We steal it from other people. Right?
Sure.
So actually, there was a kind of a very ballsy flutist who decided that he was going to transcribe a set of pieces that Paganini wrote called the 24 Caprices, Opus 1. And a caprice is really sort of like a fleeting thought, an impromptu. Okay. A short piece that's highly virtuosic that's supposed to sound like as if you just made it up on the spot.
Like it's capricious.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
A caprice, capricious, it's sort of like, okay, I'm just going to do something, pick up whatever, and I'm just jamming.
Right.
Okay. But in that, the music is extremely difficult, but it's supposed to sound easy.
Okay.
Now, I went to the Eastman School of Music, and my teacher there, Bonita Boyd, gosh, she's truly a badass. I mean, this woman can do anything. She's a legend. I mean, she's pretty special. Was Cosmopolitan Woman of the Year. In addition to just being like a ridiculous, ridiculous musician. When I was there, she recorded 24 caprices for the flute. And I was able to sit in the sound booth and listen to her play these over and over again. And I have to say, my jaw dropped. I'm saying, my God. It's superhuman, you know? It's just one of those experiences I'll never forget. And so we're going to be listening to one of those caprices that kind of takes a flute to a different level. And you're going to hear a type of virtuosity that we didn't hear in the Carmen. We're going to hear lots of fast notes. We're going to hear a technique called double tonguing. Now, how flutists separate each note, if you think about the air, you just blow consistently. You need to chop it. Mm-hmm. And the way we chop each note is by adding a syllable T or a K to how we produce a sound. So we would go T, 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 K, 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 K as we are blowing. And that's how we separate each note.
Okay.
You're going to hear how quickly she does this and how every note is kind of in its own place amid this incredible flourish of virtuosity. I think you're going to enjoy it.
Holy shit!
Right!
It's crazy!
It's like, where does she breathe?
So this is Bonita Boyd, and while this was being recorded, you were actually sitting in the sound booth.
I'm sitting in the sound booth and making notes and being like, I like this one, I don't like this one. You know, you rock this one. Yeah, that note didn't sound so great. So I'm like, oh my God.
You were reviewing it as it was being made.
Helping her. I like to think. Probably not really.
Okay, but seriously, when does she breathe?
Well, I'm sure this was, you know, some of it was spliced together.
Okay.
You'll hear a couple moments where she does. Because the music makes better sense with a breath.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that violinists don't have to stop. Crazy, right?
Holy moly.
It ends in the same way that it began with, like, these beautiful flourishes. Mm-hmm. And actually, the whole CD is stunning. I mean, you go one by one just being completely astonished that the instrument has the ability to do this. And what she's doing is highly unusual. I want to say not every flutist can do what she is able to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it is possible. Cool, right?
Yeah, super cool.
All right, well, we're going to move a little bit in time.
All right.
And experience, go to France, actually. The Paris Conservatory loved it, loved the flute, loved the sensuality of the flute. There was a lot of teachers at the Paris Conservatory that wrote their own music for their contests. And out of that tradition, which is, you know, you'll have pieces that are slow and fast, theme and variations, kind of show-offy, pretty and then cute. Not a lot of substance, though.
Okay.
You know, just the kind of stuff that you can put in the background and sort of wallow in, but not really pay a lot of attention.
So basically like the Taylor Swift of the day.
Kind of. I would say that, but of course somebody is going to get mad at me for saying that. But
Taylor Swift, all right.
Yeah.
She's just sort of, you know, she's poppy.
She is what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
And things change with a composer. His name is André Jolivet. Most people will never have heard of André Jolivet.
Mm-hmm.
Not like we think of Ravel, Debussy, Fauré, those French composers, because he wrote for a different type of instrument set. He loved a flute. Now, he did something a little different. He really expanded the avant-garde French sound with interesting scales. And by scale, I mean a collection of sounds. When you think of a scale that we sing, like do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, right? It's a collection of pitches.
Right.
But they don't all have to be those pitches. We can sort of mess around with them and change one, make it a little higher, a little lower, and come up with a completely different sound. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what he did. And he was into giving back to music its ancient sort of gravitas. He wanted to infuse it with religious beliefs and ritual and expression. And he wrote this ridiculous piece for, actually it was originally written for flute, harp, and string quartet called Chant de Linos. Translates to Song of Linus. Linus was the son of Apollo, musician, a poet who died very young. And the Chant of Linos, the Song of Linos, is really like a funeral orgy.
A funeral orgy.
It is just absolutely raucous.
Two words you don't expect to be juxtaposed.
But if you think, you know, if you were in a very tribal, ancient situation where somebody dies and people are grieving, stages of grief, you know, includes also letting go of anger.
Yeah.
And that anger can be expressed through dance, can be expressed through just volume. And that's exactly what we have here. So you're hearing this music, you'll hear the flute cry. You'll hear the flute use a technique called flutter tonguing. We talked about using syllables like taka, taka to separate the notes. Well, if you roll your tongue using the R sound, you can also play with that and get a kind of a fluttering effect. You'll get a really interesting dance in an asymmetric meter, meaning not all beats have the same length, so it's going to feel a little gimpy.
Yeah.
Like it's not 1, 2, 3, 4. It's more like 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. So it feels like I don't really know where I, you know, fit in. Exactly. And that's that sense of rhythm. It's really interesting. The pieces is really a rite of passage for flutists. It's one of these pieces that you work a lot during your life and then you're able to play it. And when you're done with it, it stays with you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of like, I consider it like your musician's bar mitzvah. You know, you go in, you do your thing, you get through it, you sweat. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe I went through this. But then later, it stays with you.
Is it, so this would not be something that's like standard repertoire. This wouldn't be something that you would do at an audition. This is something that you work toward.
Correct. It's standard repertoire in terms of chamber music.
Okay.
But it's not standard repertoire in the orchestral world. You will not hear much of Jolivet's music in the orchestral world at all. You will hear some of his contemporaries, like Messiaen.
Mm-hmm.
You will hear some of that. Jolivet, I think, was a little bit more of a traditionalist. So the piece, anyway, starts with kind of like a scream, a painful scream, followed by a lament, a crazy cadenza, and then just a nasty dance.
Yeah.
And it's really, really fun to listen to. It kind of you kind of groove to it, and it's really gritty. It has a lot of grit. It has a lot of chutzpah. You have to have a lot of balls to play.
All right, let's hear this ballsy piece.
By a scale, kind of like an interesting sound that doesn't sound like your do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do.
Yeah.
You can hear it here.
Mm-hmm. It sort of skips around a bit.
Yeah. And the intervals and the space between the notes. is unpredictable.
Yeah.
This is the lament. Here you'll hear that sonority that's so rich and ancient and exotic. Yummy.
Exotic is a good word for this piece.
So this section expresses a sadness, a longing, an understanding that that person is no longer on earth. Maybe prayer, trying to connect to the beyond.
This sounds like the musical score for modern dance.
You think?
Yeah, it really does.
This whole section is in 5 beats to a bar. That's why it doesn't feel like you can actually grab onto when the beat, the main beat starts and ends.
Yeah, it's very slippery.
Yeah. It feels like one big, long musical phrase. Like a run-on sentence.
Yeah.
There's something to that that creates angst in you. A craving for resolution.
Yes, yeah.
People say that's musical foreplay. Now we go a little crazy. Do you hear that flutter tongue in there?
Yeah.
Fun, right? We're going to return to the lamentation one more time before we get to a dance. And that dance is fantastic. You'll hear the scale again, that sonority that's unlike anything we've heard before.
It's like the musical phases of grief, almost.
Exactly.
You know?
To me, this feels very smoky, very mysterious. Yeah. As if we're preparing for a religious ritual. I love this flutist, Emmanuel Pau. Spent many years in playing principal flute in the Berlin Veil. Craziness. Isn't it? Little cadenza there and accompanied. This serves as a transition to this crazy dance. And it goes on and on like that.
That's, wow.
It's a workout.
I can see why. Yeah. I mean, God, it's just all over the place.
Correct. Correct. It really challenges you because it's the characters that you go through are crazy. And it really explores the extremes of the instrument. You know, from honking low notes to screaming high notes to beautiful floaty melodies.
Yeah.
To this kind of thing that just doesn't let up.
Yeah.
Doesn't let up. And it does really feel like musical foreplay.
Yeah.
Because you feel like, okay, when does a resolution come? When do I get to rest? Yeah, when do I get to like lie back and have my cigarette? And you don't have it.
Wow. That is really neat. You mentioned a word a couple of times, and I didn't ask you what it was. Cadenza.
Cadenza. Cadenzas are typically an unaccompanied part of, say, a showcase that exhibit the instrumentalist's virtuosity.
Okay.
So you'll hear that a lot in concertos, for example, where the orchestra ends in sort of in a moment of hesitation that, okay, we're not done, but there's no sound, nothing's happening. And then the solo instrument will start playing something that leads into, brings the orchestra back and usually ends.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that part where I mentioned that there was no accompaniment and it sounded all crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it has a feeling of a cadenza. It has a feeling that you're just sort of making stuff up as you go.
Okay. And sort of like a guitar solo in a rock song.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Sort of like, you know, when the saxophonist goes nuts in a jazz band.
Right.
Or
okay.
The drummer is like, it's their part. And that improvisation mm-hmm. equals to a cadenza. Now, a cadenza doesn't always have to be improvised. You can actually plan it out. Some people write it out.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is to have that sort of free feeling.
I see.
That you are not restrained by maybe rehearsal and what you've agreed to do, that you can just, okay, if you decide to do something else, whatever.
Yeah.
And you okay. can just go, you can just be a little bit more in the moment.
I did not know that classical music had that.
That cool?
This makes it sound effortless. Wow.
And the crowd goes wild. That's usually what happens. And that's when you want to like throw your instrument across the stage. I mean, like, can somebody get me a freaking martini?
And I'm done.
And I'm done. Give me a martini, give me a cigarette. Somebody give me a hammock and get me out to the Bahamas because this is really a workout.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. Isn't it fun to listen to?
Really fun.
Yeah.
It's just, it constantly maintains your interest because it's changing so much, but there's sort of like a central glue that's like a core that's holding it together.
It's cool.
Very cool.
All right, let's move
on. So where in the world do we go from there?
Well, okay, so let's come back home.
Okay.
And see what's happening here. You know, George Crumb is an American composer. Gosh, he's written so much wonderful music. What he does that I like so much is he makes you forget what you're listening to. You know, he takes the instruments and explores how sound is produced to create effects that are just out of this world. One of my favorite pieces is Voice of the Whale. And I love how he sets it up because it's written for three masked musicians.
Masked musicians?
So you're supposed to wear a mask while you're playing this. So
oh,
he's
wow.
thinking a lot about theatricality. He does this a lot in his music. I once played a piece of his called Edel for the Misbegotten. It's for flute and percussion. And he specifies that it's supposed to be played next to a lake on a moonlit lit evening in August. So he's thinking about specific moods when he's writing this piece.
Wow.
Voice of the Whale. And remember, we talked about Jolivet, kind of this ancient, like he wants to bring that. Crumb does something very, very similar. And Voice of the Whale is kind of, it's structured very traditionally. It has kind of an introduction and then a theme and variations. Introductions kind of sets the mood. A theme is, you know, what is going to give the piece grounding. And then he does little variations.
Okay.
What's cool is all three instruments, piano, cello, and flute, are amplified. They're electric. So you have to put a microphone. There's a specific setup that he wants. There's specific lighting. It's just really supposed to create a mood. Now, the tune of Voice of the Whale was actually inspired by the sounds of the recorded sounds of a real whale.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And when you hear this, that's a flute.
It sounds like you can hear someone's voice slightly under it. What the what?
Exactly, right?
What is that?
You got it right, by the way. It's singing and playing at the same time.
Okay.
So it's this idea that while you're blowing, you're producing sound with your throat as well.
I see.
And then when you produce the same pitch in your throat that you are producing with the instrument, you have this confluence of frequencies, of sound waves that create this sort of really, the word, I mean, I keep on using this word exotic, but I can't think of anything else. I mean, I feel like it's very deserty, very another world, very, yeah, it's phenomenal.
Reminds me of, I don't know, ancient Egyptian music or something, you know?
That's what I think, too.
Yeah, very Indiana Jones.
You actually don't have to sing and play the same pitch. You can actually sing and play sort of in polyphony with yourself.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, here comes a piano.
Piano is also what we call prepared. So hands go actually inside the piano to mute some strings, use paper clips, use really interesting things to change a timbre. That's actually produced by, you know, taking the hand and sort of running across the strings.
What is that sound in the background?
That's the singer singing through the flute.
Oh, that is through the flute as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh. Tell me, I can't remember if you mentioned this or not, but tell me when George Crumb composed this?
He's still alive.
He's still alive,
and I believe this was 1971.
Okay.
So, 4 years before I was born. But it has a very modern sound.
Yeah.
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 Cool, huh?
Very cool.
Anyway, it's great to listen to the whole piece because it will take you through just an incredible, incredible journey.
Mm-hmm. Where do we go from George Crumb? Where can you go from whale song?
Well, there's more. There's always more. And so we're going to go actually and listen to some music that's being written right now.
Okay.
And there's this dude, his name is Greg Patillo, who is actually a classically trained flutist. And he decided that wasn't for him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a little grungy guy. Sort of, if you look at him, he might look a little scary. You might tell him to actually shave, go take a bath. But he's actually a really great guy, really, really fun. And he decided that if some people could sing and play, why couldn't he beatbox and play?
Uh-huh.
So then he takes this sort of idea and brings it to the streets, you know, and sees, what can I do with this?
Yeah.
He started doing this on his own, and he created a YouTube video that went insane.
Really?
Yeah, it was like Mario. He has a YouTube video, Mario Brothers, where he beatboxes while playing the flute. And it's really phenomenal.
The Mario Brothers theme song?
Exactly.
Oh, that's
awesome. You can Google it and you'll find it. It's phenomenal. And, you know, he's just having a good time. He just, he's not thinking about career. He's just like, I just want to do beatbox flute. Why can't I? You can sing. Why can't I beatbox?
So biting, like the sound?
Yeah, he combines a lot of eccentric techniques. So he's mastered quite a few of them. He's mastered flutter tonguing, he's mastered singing and playing, and he's adding this additional sort of percussive in between the notes while he's producing the sound.
Yeah.
So he actually has to plan it very strategically when he can do his beatbox sounds so the melody keeps going.
Right, yeah. I can see that being interruptive.
Yeah. But he's learned how to do that so organically that it just fits. And it feels like you almost have a drum set there, or you have a percussion instrument, but you don't.
Yeah. Just have a beatboxing flute dude.
Correct.
Yeah. Does he have a special name for the technique?
Beatbox flute? Call it exactly what it is.
I like it.
This takes a lot of air, by the way.
Yeah, I bet.
I actually had tried to do this. I failed miserably. My ego was so hurt. And literally after a while, you start feeling like lightheaded.
Yeah, well, beatboxing is hard.
Correct. So imagine the flute also. You waste so much air. Because you're not blowing directly into the instrument. You're blowing across.
Okay.
So time's out by these things that you're trying to do to get these sounds out. And you could possibly just, you know, practice into just passing out and blacking out.
I've tried beatboxing many times. because I don't know why. But
because it's fun. Come on.
Beatboxing is awesome.
It's like the time I decided I was going to try to teach myself harmonica.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be easy.
I did that too.
It was awful. I felt like such a beginner. I'm like, what's wrong with me? You know, I've been studying music for how many years and I can't like master this metal thing that costs $20.
Right.
And
yeah.
Not cool.
That is very cool. Yeah. So, I really like that.
Yeah, very, very far from Carmen. Very far from this idea of flute as background wedding music. This is the kind of music that really fulfills musicians because it really pushes you to extremes. It's something that you have to work at to be able to do.
Yeah.
Most people talk about, you know, the emotive part of being an artist. Mm-hmm. But in order to be able to do that, you need to have the goods.
Yeah.
To be able to do exactly what you feel you want to do and not be hindered by the natural tendencies of the physicalities of the instrument that you have.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you've kind of got to close the gap between yourself and the instrument, you know, so that it's an extension of you.
Correct. And when you're going through school, gosh, you spend more time with violin with your instrument than with anything else. So you start naming them and come up with like cute little characteristics, you know, painting stuff on them.
What did you name yours?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I have three instruments. One of them is Sparky because he's kind of fun and light and bright, and I use it a lot for, you know, whenever I have to put birdie and pretty stuff. Then I have I was able to actually purchase a gold flute, which I love.
Wow.
He's a little pretentious. Uh-huh. He's a pretty boy, so I name him Pierre because when I think of French people, I think like pinky up sort of, you know.
Yeah.
And he's a little bit like that. But my favorite is actually my piccolo. The piccolo is, you know, a little flute made out of wood, pace really high, an octave like above the flute, and you get that really screeching high. His name is Hercules.
That's awesome.
Because he has a little complex, but he's just loud. He just wants to be noticed. But he has a kind of, you know, an inferiority complex.
Yeah,
he has a little Napoleon complex. At first I named him Napoleon, but it wasn't right. And then, like, I was like, Hercules, yeah, that's your name.
Mm-hmm.
He stuck with it.
Well, this really has been eye-opening. I have never really even paid that much attention to the flute. You know, of course, I had that preconceived notion that it was just this lovely instrument. It's just, yeah, I think of Zamfir, the pan flute.
Pan flute, yeah, exactly.
You know, and
yoga music, right, meditation music.
Exactly.
Massage me, rub my feet.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this was really, really neat. I really see the evolution of where this instrument has gone. Joel, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for wanting to listen.
No, this has been fantastic. Everybody, if you would like to hear a question that you have addressed on the Classical Classroom, or you have a great idea for an episode, please send me an email at dclay@classical917.org. If you want to know anything about what's on our episodes, please go to classical917.org/classroom. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.